This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane, coming to you from Nipaluna, Hobart. Early childhood education teachers are going to be the first to test the federal government's new multi-employer bargaining laws. The laws allow groups of employers in a particular sector to negotiate pay deals with unions rather than doing individual agreements. Unions representing early childhood workers in New South Wales, Victoria and the ACT are lodging the application with the Fair Work Commission. 60 employers are also participating. Tony Burke is the Minister for Employment and Workplace Relations. Good morning and welcome to AM.
Good morning.
Minister, how much of a difference to pay packets do you hope this will make in a sector where a lot of workers are women and who are often lower paid?
Look, I don't have a set percentage figure in my mind. What I'm very conscious of, and the reason the government changed the laws last year with the Secure Jobs, Better Pay Bill, was because a whole lot of people who'd got themselves in front of the award had done it through enterprise bargaining. But in feminised industries, like early childhood education, it just wasn't working. People weren't able to get the agreements moving in the same way. People kept telling us multi-employer bargaining is actually a way to fix this. And so having put the laws in place, seeing today that the first industry that's going to have a go at using these laws to try to get better rates of pay for the workforce is early childhood education, I couldn't be happier. It's not just getting wages moving. When it's a feminised industry, it also helps close the gender pay gap.
Does it mark a fundamental shift in the bargaining process towards workers?
Oh, completely. This is, we had 10 years where wages were being deliberately kept low. And what we're now seeing is people using the laws that were only changed because there was a change of government and a change of policy that came with that, that will result in getting wages moving.
These aren't the only industrial relations changes on the go. Business and farming groups have launched a national campaign against the same job, same pay policy, which isn't law yet, it's not even before Parliament, but that would make labour hire employers get the same pay as companies' permanent workers. Business says it would mean that workers won't be rewarded for their experience or hard work. Is that right?
No. Yesterday was one of the strangest debates I've ever found myself in, because business was running a passionate campaign against a policy that the government's not proposing, that the government's not going to do, and to me it would sound like a bad idea anyway. So effectively the way business were arguing yesterday, and there was even someone on PM yesterday afternoon claiming that somehow this would prevent hairdressers from being able to pay different rates of pay for the people in their employment, just not true. What we're trying to fix here is a loophole.
What's gone wrong here? Because it sounds like the relationship with business is broken down. How come things are this bad?
Business is still participating in the consultation. I can only think it's probably they've done the focus group research or something like that with some marketing company. And the actual loophole that the government's wanting to close, they discovered was indefensible. And so they've tried to go off on some sort of tangent. But the loophole's a really simple one, which is if an employer agrees with their workforce and registers, this should be the rate of pay. You shouldn't then be able to go to a labour hire company and completely undercut what you've just agreed to. Now, that's a loophole. But you know, yesterday in that business media conference, there were people saying, oh, this will affect family farms. You're hard-pressed to find too many local family farms that have got an enterprise agreement in place.
Put simply, you're trying to put a floor price in for workers, ensuring that those employed by contractors are paid the same as those employed by a permanent business. Is that it?
Well, I'd use the term labour hire rather than contractors. Like, this won't affect the contractor who turns up for a few days to repair something or anything like that. So I think labour hire is the better term. It's a labour hire loophole that we're wanting to close. But what we need to remember is setting that floor is set at the exact rate that the employer had said was a fair rate of pay, not a dollar higher. So it's only where the employer has agreed with their workforce, registered an agreement that this should be the rate of pay, that we think, well, having done that, you ought to honour it. You shouldn't be able to use some loophole that then says we can radically undercut that. A quick example, if I can. I was in the Hunter Valley a couple of weeks ago where one of the miners had worked for years as a casual doing the exact same job side by side with permanent workforce. But he was employed by Labor Hire, so even with the casual loading, he was getting a lower hourly rate than the permanent workforce. Now, that's not fair. It's a loophole. It's indefensible and needs to be closed.
Reserve Bank Governor Philip Lowe has been warning Labor MPs the generous wage rises that they've been backing could make inflation work if they're not accompanied by increases in productivity. There might be another interest rate rise today. Do you agree with the Governor's view that productivity should also increase with these wage hikes?
Oh, the government's been pushing very hard to improve productivity, and that's why the Governor himself made clear that, if anything, the budget that we've delivered has put downward pressure on inflation, if anything. So in terms of the work that needs to be done by government, we are doing that. I've seen in the last few days, since the annual wage review came down, some people effectively wanting to blame workers for any decision that the Reserve Bank might make. Now, need to remember, last year's annual wage review was only 10% of the total wage growth in the country, and that's because the people affected by the annual wage review are the people on the lowest incomes. They're the people relying on it. And some sort of argument from some that we can ignore what's happening internationally, we can ignore what's happening with supply chains, and we'll blame any interest rate decisions on whether cleaners and shop assistants get a pay rise, I just don't think it stacks up.
Tony Burke, thanks for joining AM.
Great to talk to you. See ya.
Tony Burke is the Minister for Employment and Workplace Relations. The woman once branded Australia's worst female serial killer has enjoyed her first night of freedom in 20 years. Kathleen Folbig was pardoned and released from prison yesterday after an inquiry found there was reasonable doubt about her convictions for the murders and manslaughter of her four children. Legal experts are now calling for the creation of a permanent criminal case review commission to investigate possible wrongful convictions. Oliver Gordon reports.
As Kathleen Folbig adjusts to life outside prison, parallels are being drawn to another infamous case, that of Lindy Chamberlain. Felicity Graham is a Sydney barrister.
It's worth remembering that Lindy Chamberlain was freed after about 3 years in prison when it became apparent that the system had made a mistake in her case. Kathleen Folbig has spent 20 years incarcerated, wrongly convicted, always maintaining her innocence, and she's suffered terribly in that place.
The Folbig case had been through several court appeals and an earlier inquiry, and yesterday's decision makes it one of the biggest miscarriages of justice in Australian legal history.
We can see that the current safeguards are not sufficiently robust or not sufficiently responsive to the urgency and the horror of someone being wrongly convicted. So I think there is a good case for reform in this space.
University of Sydney law professor David Hamer wants a permanent body set up, capable of investigating possible wrongful convictions.
A criminal cases review commission would be a standing commission which would have the resources to and the powers to explore the possibilities, you know, to commission experts, to interview witnesses, and to gather evidence so as to really determine whether a conviction is safe.
Would there be enough cases to keep such a commission busy, in your opinion?
Well, the experience in England, where they've had a criminal cases review commission in place for a few decades now, is that, yes, there will be plenty of work. I mean, England is a bigger jurisdiction, but even still, they receive thousands of applications a year in England, and they have to carefully filter through them to decide which ones they can really pursue.
He says the appeals process can sometimes fall short.
Having had the first appeal, the defendant doesn't have the option of a further appeal. They could take it to the High Court, but special leave is required, and the High Court will look at it in a fairly narrow fashion. And so then the defendant is in a very difficult position because they're often in prison by this time. They don't have resources. Legal aid might not be available to them anymore. And so for them to be expected to uncover fresh evidence proving their innocence, it's just extremely difficult to do.
While she's been pardoned, Kathleen Folbig's convictions can only be quashed if the inquiry chief refers her case to the Court of Criminal Appeal. If that happens, she could potentially sue the New South Wales government for millions of dollars in compensation or seek an ex gratia payment. Whatever the outcome, Barrister Felicity Graham will be watching closely.
Could any amount of money really compensate someone for being wrongly convicted and spending 20 years in jail? I don't think so.
That's Barrister Felicity Graham ending Oliver Gordon's report. Ukrainian forces appear to have made gains through Russian front lines overnight, leading to speculation the early stages of the counteroffensive may have begun. The Russian Defence Ministry says Ukraine's launched a large-scale offensive in Donetsk in the country's east, but Ukrainian officials are playing that down. Europe correspondent Steve Kinnane reports.
If the counteroffensive has begun, it's no all-out assault. Troops like the ones AM met in a secret location in the woods in eastern Ukraine are still in training. On the agenda is how to get rid of booby traps and mines, something that will be critical in the counteroffensive if they break through Russian lines. 39-year-old Andrew says the training in recent weeks has been relentless. The last weeks, every day we are training. They've given us different weapons, instructors. Many guys have gone abroad to train. We'll be better prepared than we were at the beginning of the war. Andrew worked in a supermarket before he volunteered to serve in the territorial defence. Like most soldiers in Ukraine's armed forces, he's clear-minded about the reasons why he signed up. Of course I know what I'm fighting for. My mother-in-law now lives at my house because her house was demolished. People came to us, took away our houses, our territories, and they say this is ours. That does not happen. 47-year-old Vladimir says his hometown is under occupation and he wants to help drive the Russians out for the territorial integrity and statehood of Ukraine. He says he and his comrades are grateful for the help that Ukraine has received from Western nations. Without Western weapons, it would have been much more difficult. We're very grateful to the suppliers of all our allies and friends. Those who help with weapons are giving shelter to our citizens. We are very grateful. Russia's Ministry of Defence has released a video it says shows its forces thwarting a large-scale offensive by Ukraine in Donetsk. The drone footage has not been verified, and an aide to President Zelensky warned against trusting Russian reports, describing them as a separate virtual meta-universe. Ukraine's Deputy Defence Minister, Hanna Malia, said that Ukraine was shifting to offensive actions in some areas, but dismissed suggestions that any of the probing that was currently going on was part of any major operation. Back at the training ground, the troops are getting ready for when they push to the front lines. Alexei has left his wife and young child to fight for his country, and he has high hopes for the counter-offensive. I hope we make it to the sea. The minimum task is to cut off their land route to Crimea and stay alive and unharmed. You get the sense that even these troops don't know when the big push will begin. This is Steve Kinnane reporting from eastern Ukraine for AM.
It's another tense day ahead for anyone struggling with rising mortgage repayments. The Reserve Bank might be about to add to the cost of living pain at today's monthly board meeting with what could be the 12th interest rate rise since May last year. For more on this, I spoke earlier with our senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan. Peter, what are the odds for another interest rate hike today?
Sarah, money markets see a 65% chance of another rate rise today. That would be the 12th since the RBA's cash rate started rising from near zero levels during the pandemic. But of course, money markets have been wrong before, as we saw last month when rates went up against all expectations. But chances are the RBA will be worried about inflation and deliver another quarter of a percentage point rise to 4.1%. This, of course, will add to household pain, especially for borrowers who took out loans at record low levels. Then you have fixed rate mortgages expiring pretty soon and borrowers confronting the reality of a higher rates world. And banks say they're starting to see mortgage stress, and that's only going to worsen.
The Reserve Bank's mantra has been about taming inflation. How far will it need to go to have a chance of pulling it down?
Well, inflation remains uncomfortably high, rising to 6.8% in the 12 months to April. And the Reserve Bank Governor, Philip Lowe, has made the consistent point that he'll do whatever it takes to tame inflation. And he's repeated that if inflation looks like becoming entrenched, it's better to act early rather than waiting later in the year when bigger rate rises would be needed and perhaps hundreds of thousands of jobs could end up being lost. Deutsche Bank economists see the Reserve Bank cash rate rising to 4.6% by September if there's going to be any chance of taming inflation. They're tipping the RBA to hike today at today's board meeting, with more pain to come.
What could make the bank's board hold off?
Well, some economists think the RBA board might want to stand back and wait until they see the latest economic growth or GDP figures, which are out tomorrow. Forecasts are for a soft GDP reading in the most recent quarter of 0.3%, making 2.4% over the year, perhaps a sign the economy is softening and inflation might be heading south. But unfortunately, the RBA's rate rising campaign seems far from over.
Peter Ryan. It's been more than two decades since a referendum was held in Australia, so for many, this year's vote on an Indigenous voice to Parliament will be an unfamiliar experience. The Australian Electoral Commission's joined groups in WA's Goldfields and Pilbara to run a series of mock referendums to help prepare communities, and it may be rolled out nationally. Reporter Terry Campbell went along to one at Norseman, about 700 kilometres east of Perth, to see how the process works.
Ngadju ranger Darius Evans-Wicker usually spends his days caring for country and sacred sites across the vast Norseman region. But today, he's walking along the wide streets of the town centre towards a pop-up polling booth.
I've come along just to get a better understanding of what a referendum is, because I have absolutely no idea what it is.
The 23-year-old is at a mock referendum run by the Australian Electoral Commission and the Goldfields Aboriginal Language Centre.
I'm just going to shake these ballots all out.
It aims to prepare residents in remote WA communities to vote on the proposed Indigenous voice to Parliament later this year. Danielle Savage is the Electoral Commission's Acting State Manager for WA.
So we're out here in Norseman today doing voter education sessions, doing a practice referendum. So it's really exciting times to be out here.
Across Australia, 97% of the eligible population is enrolled to vote. But among Indigenous Australians, that number drops to 85%. In Western Australia, the Indigenous enrolment rate is the lowest in the country at 74%. Danielle Savage hopes these mock referendums will help change that.
So we acknowledge that our rates are a little bit lower, but we're so vast, and that's the challenge for us out here. But that's why we're out and about, so that we can make sure that we get those enrolment numbers up.
Locals came up with the mock referendum question, whether Norseman the horse, the town's namesake, is more famous than the tin camels on its roundabout. Sue Hansen, the CEO of the Goldfields Aboriginal Language Centre, says they hope it's a topic everyone understands.
Of course, the referendum question's written in standard Australian English, and the sentence structure and the ways that the questions are asked are different to how they would be phrased in Aboriginal languages. Miscommunication or a lack of communication is a very big issue. So we're helping to translate the referendum question at the moment into a number of languages.
We'll open this ballot here first.
By midday, the final count is in.
For the motion that is Norseman the horse more famous than the tin camel roundabout, the motion is yes. So that passes as a referendum if it was one. So congratulations to Norman the horse.
Darius Evans-Wicker is pleased his vote matched the winning side.
Because I'm also a logical thinker, because a lot of tourists do come by and see the camels.
But importantly, he's now enrolled and feeling more at ease going into his first referendum on The Voice.
It was a lot more simpler than what I imagined it would be.
The AEC's next stop is Warburton, south of the Gibson Desert, and it's hoping to run other mock referendums around the country later in the year.
Terry Campbell reporting there. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. She was once dubbed Australia's worst serial killer after the deaths of her four children. But now Kathleen Folby is a free woman after spending two decades in jail. Today, ABC Background Briefing reporter Rachel Brown on Kathleen Folbig's freedom and what it says about the judicial system. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.